So I'm going to present two things today. One is propensity score techniques, which I find very fascinating. And there's just so many of them out there today that it's hard to choose between which one to use in which situation. And the second part of the talk, I'm going to go into the research question, which is looking at cannabis or marijuana use and whether or not it causes depression. So we usually use multivariable regression techniques to control for confounding. But regression techniques, they're good for associations. They're not particularly great for when you want to do a causal association. So if you want to claim causality between a risk factor and an outcome, you need to use a more advanced statistical method. And one of those advanced statistical methods is known as propensity score adjustment. And so propensity score techniques, they control for confounding just like a multivariable regression model would, but they're particularly good because they control for confounding in a causal research question. And what they do is they balance the observed covariates that you're trying to control for in an attempt to recreate what we would have gotten if we were able to have a random assignment of the treatment or the risk factor. In propensity score adjustment literature, they often call the main risk factor the treatment. So I'll be referring to it as treatment. So just a little bit more background. Typical regression methods, they control for confounding by holding them constant in the final model to remove their influence. So they work on this arrow of the diagram. But in propensity score techniques, they balance confounders between the treated and the non-treated to remove their influence. So they're actually working on the other arrow in this causal diagram. Propensity score techniques can be thought of as a two-step process. The first step, just briefly, is estimating the propensity score. And the propensity score is the predicted probability of your treatment given all of your confounding covariates that you've identified or observed in your study. And there have been a lot of papers out by Rubin and all of his colleagues about formalizing propensity score techniques, begun in the mid-80s. it's a probability between 0 and 1. And what I've found so far is that there's, in fact, three or even more, but I focused on three different ways to actually estimate the propensity score. And I'll get into describing those ways in more detail. The second step is actually applying the propensity score to your research question. And so you want to correct for these missing potential outcomes that you have in your data. And in fact, I've identified five different ways that you can even apply the propensity score. So a little bit more detail about estimating your propensity score. Again, it's the predicted probability of your treatment given all of your confounding covariates. The first two ways I used multivariable logistic regression. So my treatment's a binary outcome. And in the first step of estimating the propensity score, you don't think of your real outcome at all. That doesn't come into your equation. But what you do is you run a multivariable logistic regression model controlling for all the confounding covariates to predict treatment. The two different things that I did to predict the propensity score in this first parametric technique was just first adding them linearly, and then also in a second model adding some interaction terms. And there's more description by DeHaeser and Waba as to some other steps you can go through to make a more complex estimation model if you're using a parametric estimation technique. The third is a non-parametric estimation technique that was worked on specifically by a team of statisticians from RAND Corporation, and it's called generalized boosted modeling. And it's a regression tree technique, and you can implement it through an R statistical package called TWANG, and it runs the function of generalized boosted modeling. The second step when you want to apply your propensity score, as I said, there were five different ways that I identified that you could apply it. The first two ways involve matching and are similar to thinking about a matched case control study where you identify a treated individual, and in the first case you would do one-to-one matching. So you would take one treated individual and then match them to some a control individual who has similar distributions of their confounding covariates, and you match on the propensity score. The second, this first technique is a one-to-one matching. You can imagine you usually don't have 50-50, 50% treated, 50% control. You often have fewer people who have the treatment, and so you lose a lot of control individuals in this technique. One way to overcome that is to do this full matching technique in which all the control individuals get matched, so you have groups of controls or groups of treated matched to a single control just to match everybody in your sample. A third very common technique of applying your propensity score is subclassification, in which you would divide your distribution of your propensity score up into many subclasses, and then within each subclass you would run a regression. And then you would average your regression results across all of those subclasses. The last two techniques are weighting methods. The most popular is called the inverse probability of treatment weights. This is used by Robbins group at Harvard and many, many other researchers. And what they do is you do the inverse of your propensity score. If you're a treated individual, here I have 1 over PS as the equation. If you're a control individual, you get 1 over 1 minus your propensity score. And that actually is your weight in your sample. And everyone gets weighted. In the final method, which was brought into the literature by Hirano et al., was to actually change your propensity score into an odds. And the treated individuals do not get weighted. They're just treated as they are in the sample. But the control individuals get weighted by their odds. So with these three different estimation techniques and 5 different application techniques, I could have 15 different models that I could run and 15 different effect estimates in the end. And so when I was working on my dissertation, I was thinking, well, how am I going to choose between all these different techniques? And what if I run them and I get one that gives me a totally different answer? And how do I explain that? And what happens in real life is that some researchers know one particular software package, and not all of these techniques are offered by all the different software packages, and so they generally just use one of them, or they use the one they've learned. And so what I wanted to do is compare all these different techniques to see if they gave me very different results, or if there was a method that I could use to choose which technique to use before I actually involve my outcome variable. Whoops, that's a little preview. So the way that I decided to choose, I didn't come up with this. This is a statistic that we're familiar with in basic statistics. It's the effect size. So for each covariate, in this example I use age, which is a continuous variable here, and you might have different distributions of age between your treated and your control group. And what you can do is calculate this effect size statistic to show you how big of a difference you have between these two groups. And in the literature, it's been published that it's ideal if you want to say your groups are not different or they're very similar, you want to have an effect size below 0.25, and that's sort of an arbitrary cutoff that I didn't come up with, but I've been using. So what you want here is you want to be able to have your distributions of your ages between your two groups to be relatively similar to have a small effect size. And so what I did was, before I applied all the propensity score techniques, I calculated the effect size for all the confounding covariates. After applying all the different methods, I recalculated the effect sizes to see which of the methods gave me the smallest effect sizes for all of my covariates. And in fact, I came up with 3 different decision criteria to think about how to choose this effect size. So first, I wanted just the smallest effect size on average across all the confounders. Second, I wanted to pinpoint theoretically critical confounders to make sure those were balanced between my two groups. And third, to minimize the number of extreme effect sizes. So even though I had majority of effect sizes really low, I didn't want to have one confounder that was just really poorly balanced left in my analysis. So I know you might not be able to read the axes, but the effect size is on the y-axis. And on the x-axis are the 15 different techniques. And I've circled the one technique that gave me the lowest median effect size and the smallest range of values of effect size. And this is the combination of techniques that I chose to run in my final model. So it turned out that for these data, and it's going to be specific to the data set and the research question, but for these data, I found that weighting by the odds, or the generalized boosted modeling estimation, which was that non-parametric estimation, and the weighting by the odds gave me the best combination for these data. And so this is the combination of techniques that I used. So now I'm switching on to the research question, where I'll show you how I applied those techniques. So the research question of interest, I've been on a drug dependence training grant for the time at Hopkins, funded by NIDA. So I'm particularly interested in drug abuse and its relationship with mental health disorders. And particularly, I've been focusing on problem cannabis use and whether or not it's a cause of young adult major depression. So there's been some debate in the literature. There's a great review article by Dangenhart, Hall, and Linsky, who go into all the different studies that have led up to whether or not cannabis causes depression, or maybe depression causes cannabis, or perhaps there is some underlying cause for both of these disorders, which is a common genetic or environmental cause. So they do a great job of highlighting the debate, but the debate continues. So I thought what we need to do is apply some improved statistical methods to this research question to test this actual causation claim. And in their study, they said there's a lack of longitudinal cohort studies, and they don't properly control for confounding. And also, what's critical is to control for baseline or childhood depressive symptoms, because we know that depression is a reoccurring disorder throughout your lifetime, and it might not be what you're doing in between. It might just be that you're going to have depression over and over again. And finally, what I've applied here is testing actually causal pathways. So we have this great data set from Hopkins in the Department of Mental Health from the Prevention Research Center, which is a longitudinal study started in the mid-80s when these kids entered first grade. So they're about 6 years old. And it was to test different primary school interventions to improve behavior and learning abilities for later outcomes on mental health and drug use outcomes. So in our study, I pinpointed a suspected cause, which was the onset of cannabis abuse or dependence during adolescence. So if you abused or were dependent on marijuana before the age of 17, you're categorized as having the treatment in my study. The outcome is past year young adult major depression, which is measured up to age starting around between 19 and 23. So we've measured these kids from 6 years old to their mid-20s repeatedly over time. And the confounders here, I've just listed a bunch of them. The key ones are depression and other substance use like cigarettes and alcohol. So here's a graphical display. Our final sample of in the young adult interview, which started about 2,300 kids, and I have 1,500 in my study 15 years later. And so we're testing whether or not this treatment of adolescent cannabis use causes young adult depression, controlling for baseline confounders that happen before the treatment occurs. So these are all measured before age 12. So again, in our methods, we, as I showed you, explored 15 different ways to apply and estimate and apply the propensity score. And then I assessed the ability of each of these techniques to balance my baseline confounders using this statistic known as covariate effect size. And then I chose the best combination of techniques by using my different decision criteria, and I came up with the generalized boosted modeling as the estimation technique, and the weighting by the odds as the application technique. So here are our results. So we regressed adult major depression on adolescent cannabis problem use after weighting by the odds of the propensity score. And we found that if you were a problem cannabis user, you had about 33% increased odds of young adult major depression compared to if you were not a problem cannabis user, But as you can see with the confidence interval here, this is not a statistically significant positive association. Some of the limitations of this study is that we do not balance unmeasured confounders. But if you think about regular regression techniques, you can't balance unmeasured confounders in a regular regression either. So it's sort of the same limitation that we have with the regular methods that are out there. There's also a potential recall bias because we relied on self-reported drug data from all of these individuals. We didn't actually measure anything in their blood or their urine. And some of the strengths is that we had longitudinal data from childhood through adulthood, and the study is still ongoing. It just got refunded. I believe it's starting up again soon. They're probably in their late 20s now, I think. So we use multiple propensity score techniques, and there are more than 15 out there. I just highlighted the most popular ones, and 15 was my limit. I couldn't do any more than that. So also I achieved balance on numerous baseline confounders, and that technique I chose, all of the confounding covariate effect sizes were, there was one that was at 0.25, but all the other ones were below, so it was a very good technique to balance. And just as a final, we did find, we failed to find statistical support for a causal association between adolescent problem cannabis use and young adult major depression. So they're not, if you were an adolescent problem cannabis user, you're not significantly more likely to suffer adult depression, even after controlling for over 15 confounders and balancing these two groups. And also, we did use multiple propensity score techniques, and they yielded similar results in inferences. Although I only showed you one, I can show you this graph now, which in the end I did run all of them, and the one that I've circled is the one I reported to you. But quickly, they're grouped in terms of the five different application techniques, and they're ordered. The first one is the parametric multivariable logistic regression to estimate the propensity score. The second one is the more complex model where I added some interaction terms to improve the model fit. And the third one in each sequence is the generalized boosted modeling. And we do have odds ratio ranges, and they were all positive, but only one of them is statistically significant. And if there's any questions about that, I can talk more about it. And so some of our ongoing work, right now my advisor and I are working on some simulations to back up these decision criteria that I've chosen to help other researchers to pick which technique they want to use in their data set. And I'm also interested in exploring other econometric techniques for modeling causal pathways between drug use disorders and mental disorders, because not just statistics, but there's this whole other realm of econometrics that uses different models, and I'm sort of interested in seeing what their models tell me as well. So thank you. I had a couple grants that I worked under, and special thanks to all my mentors at Hopkins and mentors at RAND. Thanks. Questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The first two are not, in fact. They do not, they cross one. On this graph, it's hard to see, because I think I drew this line myself. So it's a little offset, but they do just barely cross. The last one doesn't. There's a final distinction that I didn't mention between these techniques. So the first three are called, the application is known as the effect of the treatment on the treated. So it's the average treatment effect on the treated population. So what it is actually estimating is the effect of the treatment, which is cannabis use, on those who did use cannabis compared to if I were to take just those treatment individuals and make them not use cannabis. The last two techniques, the definition of the effect for subclassification weighting by the odds, is more of a population level effect. It's a bigger group. So it's the effect of the treatment, it's just the average treatment effect in the treated versus the bigger group of people, not just among those treated, but among everyone who was not. So there have been some papers written about this that talk about how the effects are always a little bit bigger if you're doing all these different estimations, and it's a question of, I think, generalizability, because they have a slightly different effect in terms of interpretation. So in our study, we thought about this a little bit, and we thought, well, do we want the average treatment effect among the treated, or we just want the average treatment effect? And what we decided is that actually having the average treatment effect among the treated makes more sense, because in our case, treatment is drug use. In other cases, treatment is something that you can feasibly say that the control group might have done. But in this case, the control group is what didn't use drugs, and there isn't any way that we were going to make them use drugs. So in our case, what we decided even is to run my decision criteria separately for the first three, to choose one out of those, and then for the second two. But in fact, in this research question, it's really only makes sense to take an interpretation from the first three. Does that make sense? Yep. It's a great question, though. Yeah. Oh. Well, that's why I didn't use it, because my advisor is a student of Don Rubin. Well, don't tell her, but I think I did run it. It didn't give me something totally different from what I was finding. So, right, so what he's talking about is you would take your predicted probability of treatment, so you take your propensity score, and it is it could be a continuous variable between 0 and 1. You could treat it many different ways, I guess, but you just put it in as a covariate into your regression. Maybe you put it in as subclasses of the propensity score, but it's actually one of those terms you put in your final regression. And that is not how I handled it here. And as he mentioned, the person who made propensity scores famous doesn't, although he wrote about it in one of his papers as one of an option, he later regretted putting it in.